coming up on Path to Zero.
As we see extreme weather events on the rise and generation supply that can't keep up, microgrids are becoming more and more of a central strategy for meeting grid needs.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, President and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
In this episode of Path to Zero, we're diving into one of the most urgent challenges in energy: how to keep the lights on and critical services running when extreme weather or grid failures strike. Joining me is Joel Yu, Senior Vice President of Policy and External Affairs at Enchanted Rock, a company that's become a national leader in microgrids and resilient power solutions. Enchanted Rock has helped hospitals, data centers, and cities across the nation adopt microgrids, which are designed to provide both backup power during grid disruptions and grid support by feeding power back into the utility grid when needed. Joel, it's great to see you, and thanks for joining us. Welcome to Path to Zero.
Hi, Tucker. Thanks for having me.
Look, we've got a lot to cover, but I think, in fairness to our listeners, you probably want to tell them a little bit about Enchanted Rock, one of my favorite, you know, stories in America, I think. Maybe even enlighten them a little bit about microgrids and just tell them about your day-to-day world.
Yeah, Enchanted Rock is a leading resiliency microgrid developer based out of Houston, Texas. We've got a little over a gigawatt of capacity deployed and under construction today, over 300 sites. A lot of our work started in critical facilities like water, hospitals, nursing homes, grocery stores, logistics, manufacturing. And our business continues to evolve as we see industry looking for more microgrid type solutions. I should step back and define microgrid. I'm chair of the board for a nonprofit educational group called Think Microgrid. And we're trying to get the word out on the work that Enchanted Rock and our allies are doing in the space, really to bring on-site generation resources co-located with load that can disconnect from the grid during outage conditions and extreme weather events to provide resiliency to that load, but can also operate synchronously with the grid to provide critical services like capacity or ancillary services or energy when the grid needs it.
And Joel, I know I love your career because your career really started around policy. And now you're working with a group that I would say maybe is leading the nation in deployment. So, and you're also, we're going to talk about your Texas roots, because I think Texas is also leading the energy revolution in many ways. But maybe start about how you see the policy implications of resilient microgrids. How do they fit? Because frankly, you don't read about them in most of the energy press. We're talking about, is the race on or off for solar or wind or battery storage or nuclear or geothermal? We never talk about what I would call the edges, of which certainly microgrids would certainly be one of the solutions. So if you will, wrap your views around policy and then this actual deployment of resilient microgrids.
Yeah, I think the most rudimentary form of microgrid historically has been the diesel backup generator. It allows you to island from the grid. There have been some markets that allow diesel generators to provide demand response. And in that way, you know, that's the earliest form of microgrid, but they've been kind of out of the spotlight in the policy discussions because of numerous challenges, including the high emissions, the air permit limits they run into, the overall reliability rate from those types of deployments historically hasn't been great. And so I think, you know, the policy discussions have largely looked at those assets as kind of extra credit to the grid, not a core strategy for meeting the needs of reliability and resiliency. But as we see extreme weather events on the rise, we're staring down resource adequacy risks with demand growth and generation supply that can't keep up. I think microgrids are becoming more and more of a central strategy for meeting grid needs. Not to say that microgrids are going to solve 100% of the grid's needs, but if you're looking at a portfolio of solutions, microgrids have to be a part of the mix. And
do policy people understand that, you think?
I think they're beginning to. Certainly, you know, some of the work we've been doing at Enchanted Rock to educate folks and kind of uncover the opportunities there have driven some positive discussions where, you know, microgrids, because they're a shared asset between the host critical facility and the grid, there's a win-win for consumers. The host customer can access backup power economically without subsidy, and the grid gets what looks like a peaking plant or a supply resource, really, downstream of transmission and distribution constraints that's got a higher performance rate than your traditional bulk scale resources. So I think folks are giving it a hard look.
And just to clarify, the owner of a microgrid may be able to provide power, islanded power, as you said. So when there is no utility scale grid connected, they can produce power with their microgrid. They may actually have a combination of power from the microgrid as well as power from the utility. And I guess sometimes they may choose to provide power back to the utility, right? That's the, and I know you've perfected that algorithm to a degree where you're constantly looking at how to get the lowest cost of energy to your customer and perhaps how to make the biggest return for your investment, right? You have all those options available to you.
That's right. That's right. It's the beauty of the microgrid strategy that you have a lot of flexibility in how you design and optimize resources, and you could really tailor a solution to whatever the grid needs in that particular location.
Right. Now, the other thing that's interesting to me, you're speaking to me today from Austin, I believe. I know you and I first met in Houston, but you're very Texas thinking. One of your early on customers, for those of us who are grocery store people, you know, HEB. And I know you really cut your original algorithms around maybe HEB. You've done some high profile hospitals. But when we think of Texas, we think of fiercely independent, including the grid. I also think of probably the most development of solar, and maybe now certainly natural gas. Yet you're living in a place where microgrids are popular. How is it that Texas has come, you know, with this robust power network? How is it that Texas needs to rely on microgrids?
Yeah, I'd say for our business, certainly the Gulf Coast area drove a lot of demand over time. You know, every time you had significant power outages, critical facilities, we're looking for solutions that work. And so we've managed to grow significantly that way. Winter Storm Uri was a huge event in Texas, driving major outages across the state. And in those days, we saw our whole fleet up and running through the event to power critical facilities. And I think it was a bit of a wake-up call for those who hadn't made investments in resiliency. And for those who did, it was a great win for their communities. And some of our partners made national news because folks were going to their facilities for charging and heating and critical supplies, or we were keeping family members safe in the nursing home context. or hospital context. I think all of those pressures have resulted in a really strong interest in microgrids, but we've also been able to deploy quickly and at scale because of a robust competitive market where we can access price signals for the grid services we provide. And that's been really helpful.
Yeah, really interesting. Yeah, I was curious if Winter Storm Uri had, you know, big impact, and it's kind of nice to hear you say it certainly did. Well, I've been talking to you for almost 10 minutes, and I haven't mentioned it yet, but it's a great time to talk about this DOE report that was issued probably now 3 months ago on energy reliability. And frankly, I don't think the general public could possibly be aware of what that report said, but it talked about a massive shift in the lack of reliable grids. Has that report done and had caused you to have more business or to entertain more customers? Or what has been the impact of that DOE report on the fragility of the grid?
Yeah, I think the DOE report, if we're looking at the same report, was largely focused on emerging risks around resource adequacy, the supply and demand balance during extreme weather events or critical peaks. And you know, in this environment of high load growth and lagging infrastructure from a supply and delivery perspective, I think the DOE report was really uncovering risks that we had already been seeing in the markets and that partners have already been seeing as well. It has driven more demand, and that comes in the form of, you know, certain areas with market signals like the PJM market in the mid-Atlantic. We see forward prices now quite escalated in response to that risk in the grid. That makes our economics a lot more attractive for potential customers who are looking to deploy resiliency microgrids. In other areas, we've been having really robust discussions with utilities who are vertically integrated and responsible for keeping the lights on with an integrated generation and delivery plan. Because when you're working on a plan that suddenly is trying to solve for gigawatts of demand growth, driven by reshoring of manufacturing, data centers, and whatnot, you need to be able to track with the timelines to meet that demand growth. And I think a lot of folks are feeling pretty tight on meeting those deadlines through traditional mechanisms of large-scale generation and large-scale transmission. I think that's where microgrids really shine, is that they can kind of fill in the gaps and bridge from a customer's needs to the traditional grid solutions. It can fit into constrained load pockets and solve for resource adequacy type concerns faster than traditional solutions as well.
Right. And if you look, I looked at that report, of course, I live in the PJM region, and I mean, it's scary for price as much as reliability. And they also, I think, really highlighted the Midwest ISO, MISO, that talked about it very vulnerable because of shutdowns and growth. And I think it just calls out, if we could agree on what is the perfect solution for utility scale power, we're 10, 12, 15 years away probably from having those solutions be producing power at scale. So I think it gives a lot of credit to the fact that these microgrids, these alternative forms of decentralized power, they're really going to fill the gap in for sure for the next decade or two. It's time for a break. We'll get back to our conversation with Joel Yu with Enchanted Rock Power Solutions after this.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people, with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. Joel Yu from Enchanted Rock is our guest, and we're talking about how microgrids are delivering both backup power and grid support. I noticed Texas recently approved new funding for microgrids, which is really interesting. You want to tell us about that?
Sure. This grew out of also the Winter Storm Uri experience. The legislature and voters approved what is a $10 billion Texas Energy Fund. A big chunk of that is going towards large-scale gas generation and non-ERCOT projects, but $1.8 billion, that's a B, is going towards backup power packages that are essentially microgrids to serve critical facilities across the state. The state is willing to subsidize a combination of solar storage and gas or propane fired generation to ensure that the experience of Winter Storm Uri, where critical facilities were exposed and out of power for, you know, days to over a week at a time, that that doesn't happen again. The program is still in rulemaking with the commission. The Public Utility Commission has it scheduled for a proposed rulemaking later this year. So we'll see how the program rules actually shape up. But there's a lot of promise there for customers who may previously have been economically pressed to deploy their own microgrids because of capital constraints or due to lack of expertise in energy modeling and microgrid deployment. The state will now come in and support that, and we can get a lot more folks covered.
That's great. It's really exciting. All right, I wasn't going to mention it until you did, and now you've done it, so I can. Because historically, for the last 20 years, most of this microgrid work really centered around diesel-fueled generators. And I know your business was built probably from almost the beginning around natural gas or propane generators. And hence, the conversation is, you use it a lot, about resilient. You're actually now providing resilience and clean. But what is the role? I mean, well, let me first off, what is the role of clean, low carbon fuels like propane and natural gas in this story? And are you beginning to see less and less diesel fired equipment as you begin to deploy, I guess, the latest technologies?
Yeah. I'll say we started in the diesel generator business actually many years ago and decided to transition to natural gas and propane on the basis of economics, emissions, and reliability. For many of our customers, the emissions related to diesel generators was not something they wanted. You know, outside the window of residences, either their own operations or neighbors. We've got, you know, sites where, due to how we're positioned behind a customer property, we're just over the fence from folks' apartment buildings or public schools. And the particulate matter emissions from diesel is pretty significant and a driver for major air quality concerns. Natural gas and propane are really effective in lowering those emissions and being able to tell the story of the microgrid being a good neighbor to the community. Besides the particulate matter, some of the other criteria pollutants as well are orders of magnitude cleaner when you're running generation on gas and propane. And that's become a really valuable benefit when you're talking about larger loads that are trying to figure out how to permit their facility from an air emissions perspective. You can serve larger loads with gas or propane than you could with diesel, and you can run those assets for more hours than you can with diesel because of that emissions profile. And then, you know, we are a business of resilience. We like the underground infrastructure that's available with natural gas that provides a measure of resiliency that the electric system is really lagging. You know, many of our customers are served with overhead electrical distribution. It's very costly to underground those lines just for a single customer, but the gas infrastructure is already underground. And if we can tap into that, there's built-in resiliency for the customers there. And when it comes to, you know, firming up some of that gas supply, propane's a great solution for stored fuel on site, allowing us to create another layer of depth in our resiliency strategy for customers.
Interesting to me that you just talked a lot about the emissions benefits of natural gas and propane, and you didn't use words that are in the narrative today when I read the climate press, because you talked about health effects, particulate matter, NOx emissions. I think if I'd let you go, you would have talked about sulfur oxide emissions, things that really impact our lung health, our plant health, but perhaps not the climate's health. Yet the whole conversation in the environmental world is around greenhouse gases. It is interesting to me that you talk to about, I think, what is the main primary issue, right, is what will harm our lungs, our children's lungs, our plants and animals. How important is that whole conversation when you're choosing a fuel and you're choosing to permit a location?
The climate considerations for Enchanted Rock are primarily driven by our customer needs. You know, there are still, you know, many customers we have who have commitments they've made on carbon reduction and carbon emissions. And so we've developed strategies to address those concerns where we can use hydrogen blends or renewable natural gas, biomethane, to decarbonize our units. What I will say is I do think the decarbonization stack of solutions is probably more economic at the bulk grid level than on the on-site resiliency microgrid level. The work we're doing is, you know, really hard to do on-site with pure zero emissions technologies for a number of reasons. You know, when we are looking at a hospital in an urban area that may be, you know, 5, 10, 15 megawatts, if you were to try to go pure zero carbon emissions with on-site power for 72 hours of resiliency in the case of a grid outage, they just don't have land or space to accommodate that type of deployment.
It's expensive. It's land intensive.
Yep.
It's a lot of things that you just don't have, right?
That's right. That's right. The economics are challenging as well.
Yeah, really, really interesting. It is. It's just interesting to me, and I'm involved in a great conversation right now in all 50 states that we work in, where I think the governor's environmental and energy advocates are realizing that the path they're on, where they were rethinking the value of coal and oil, is not going to get them at all to the place they need to get with their climate. It might make their grid more robust, but it's not going to serve them when they start looking at emissions. So it's really, I've always been appreciative of that Enchanted Rock, you know, look to natural gas or propane. And in fairness, natural gas first when there was an appropriate main. And just for our listeners, I know you talk here about hospitals. I've worked with you quite a bit on grocery stores. What are some examples of other key clients? And then you just mentioned 3 to 5 megawatts. What is the sweet spot for you in terms of power node?
Well, actually, one more thought on the decarbonization question before we leave.
We welcome any revisits on that.
I do think natural gas and propane fire generation is an important piece to the broader decarbonization strategy for the grid, where if we're deploying larger and larger amounts of solar and wind resources on the grid, there's a net peak that needs to be served with batteries to some extent, but also these long duration resources natural gas and propane can provide, where if you have a multi-day low wind period during a supply emergency, you have those assets to backfill what's there. So, you know, this is not the perspective of most environmental organizations, but we at Enchanted Rock definitely feel like natural gas has a role to play in supplementing increased renewable penetration on the grid. So it's a supportive and complementary strategy. I guess going to your prior question on customer classes and the sweet spot for size, we serve customers ranging from 0.5 megawatt of load up to, right now, our largest customer under contract is a 60 megawatt data center out in California. But our discussions in the pipeline today are taking us into customer sites that are over a gigawatt in scale. It's the beauty of the technology that we can kind of scale and design the system to fit with the architecture that our customers require. And because of its flexibility and performance profile, we can scale that up and down pretty effectively across the spectrum. Besides the hospitals and grocery stores, we're talking to an increasing number of manufacturers. This reshoring of manufacturing and the AI supply chain, I think, is driving a lot of interesting discussions for us. We're seeing logistics centers, so distribution centers that are electrifying their fleets, that put a big demand on the electric grid, needing on-site generation solutions for backup power and for peak shaving, or what we're calling bridge power, that is like a temporary utility grade power from the on-site microgrid until there's grid interconnection. And then besides those classes, we continue to work with the DoD on military installation resiliency. We're serving an Army Corps of Engineers site already in Mississippi, and we're looking to do a lot more in that space. We have additional food services, like food manufacturing type facilities, also coming into play, not just the grocery stores at retail, but upstream of those facilities. So it's a pretty robust pipeline of demand for resiliency today.
Wow, really, really exciting. Joel, we like to have some fun, and we used to ask this question almost just for fun, but it's funny, after 130 episodes of this podcast, sometimes these answers are the most important. I'm going to hand you in a moment a magic wand, and you can use that wand one time for one thing in the next year, so lots of ones, that you think would have the biggest impact regarding the energy transition as you see it. Joel, how would you use that magic wand?
I would want to see grid operators embrace the concept of flexibility to solve for our grid constraints today. on reliability and resiliency. The work that microgrids can put in to solve for the transmission and distribution constraints, but also that supply imbalance that is hard to keep in check as load is growing quickly. That flexibility requires a shift in the operating paradigm for the grid. We're used to serving customers as 24/7 firm loads. We plan to deliver their peak demand on the system no matter what. And it means that we usually underutilize our grid infrastructure. If we can tap into the value that's out there in underutilized infrastructure by supplementing with flexible, dispatchable microgrid capacity behind new loads, I think there's going to be value for the grid, value for the customers, and really help unlock the energy dominance that we're talking about right now in this environment. It's a tough thing to do, I guess, we're doing all the education and advocacy that we can, but if I had a magic wand, I think opening up some hearts and minds to flexibility would be the number one thing.
That's a great use of your wand, and it is really important because I think everyone acknowledges, probably even the independent operators acknowledge, that perhaps the world is changing faster than they have the ability to, right? Both in demand, opportunities, and as you say, we've moved past in large utility scale operators, and it's much more complicated than that now as we think about the solutions. That's a great use of your wand. Thank you. Last thing we do is, it's always great to see you and kind of catch up. I get a little snippet of you in the news, I think, almost every week. But in exchange for the time you spend with us and your expertise, we want to plant a tree in a national forest in your name, in your honor. Is there a particular forest that you would have us plant that tree?
Yeah, in the spirit of embracing Texas as home, I guess I'd say Sam Houston National Forest would be a great place to go. Yeah, we're headquartered in
Houston. I was 50% sure you'd pick a New York property there. You have become a Texan, haven't you?
Yeah. I think, you know, I love the idea of planting a tree for the discussions we're having on resilience and climate and energy. It's important to our communities, and you know, the work we're doing is holistic in nature. We're trying to solve many problems all at once with the microgrids we're deploying, and want to keep the environment beautiful for our communities as well.
Yeah, so I certainly would recommend people going to the Enchanted Rock website just to learn a little bit more about who's there and what you do. But is there anything else you want to tell our listeners on Path to Zero about either exciting new projects or something we didn't talk about?
Yeah, I briefly touched on the bridge power strategy that we're deploying for some customers. You know, definitely keep a lookout for some exciting announcements on that front. I think it's a quickly emerging opportunity space for microgrids and for large customers to get online and timeline say they need to. And, you know, from our perspective, that strategy is really what's going to unlock AI dominance, energy dominance domestically going forward.
Absolutely. Well, you've talked about a lot of great, topics that may or may not even be really in the mainstream press. You've talked about the relevance of reshoring and what that's going to do for demand. We talked a lot about the DOE grid report, which I think showed some real weaknesses. We've talked about AI demand, and I don't think we know yet quite the extent of that, both good and bad. So, and certainly Enchanted Rock has been in the middle of this since you formed. And I know you'll continue to be. So, Joel, thank you so much for being with us and spending time with us on Path to Zero.
Thanks, Tucker. It's great chatting with you, as always.
Thanks for listening to Path to Zero. If you enjoyed our discussion, please subscribe and leave a review on your favorite podcast app or YouTube. You can also find our interviews and more insights on Substack at pathtozero.substack.com. We'll see you next time.